The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. For a long time, I've wanted to talk to pediatric orthopedic surgeons and have not had really much luck. And we've had the terrific good fortune. Now, last month, we were able to talk to Dr. John Heflin. This month, we have the continued good fortune to talk to his partner, Marcella Wojcik. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you for having me.
As I think we're both aware, you have had quite a history in education, in teaching, and we're just very fortunate to have you engaged in this. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Buffalo, New York, and I stayed there until I was 17, and then I went off to college in Cleveland, Ohio, and then did my med school in Toledo, Ohio. My orthopedic residency I did in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And then I landed in Utah, where I've been since 2007. I came here for my fellowship training in pediatric orthopedics. And so I've been here now 16 years.
Glad to have you here. I mean, you've sort of been inching west, haven't you?
I have.
We're glad that you landed here. Before we start talking today about foot and leg deformities, do you have anything, any conflicts to disclose?
I don't have any disclosures, no.
Well, then let's just get started. It's one of the most common concerns that people have about infants especially, and we'll talk about infants throughout the range of pediatric lifespan, but are that things just aren't lining up correctly. We get questions about that all the time. Why do things not line up correctly?
Well, so I think there's various reasons that things don't line up correctly. One of the things that can happen in utero is that there's some changes in how the baby is positioned, and that can affect how the baby comes out and some of the orthopedic things that we then see and get to deal with. From a positional perspective, two things that I see a lot of in my office is metatarsus adductus, where the foot is curved like a kidney bean. And then I also often get questions about torticollis and hip dysplasia. We also see developmental issues that can happen with kids. I think we'll talk about that in a little bit greater detail, but there's definitely some normal things that happen to kids that parents maybe didn't expect were supposed to happen because maybe their first or second child didn't have those things happen and it's just more obvious in the subsequent child. And then there's certainly some abnormal developmental things that can happen in kids from a neurologic perspective and otherwise that we see.
And part of this is generational too, isn't it? I'm old enough that my oldest son had some tibial torsion and had some hideous shoes prescribed that he was supposed to wear. And then somebody had the temerity to do a large controlled study and found they made no difference at all. And an industry went out of business overnight. But because there are still parents and grandparents around, a lot of times somebody may see something and say, that just can't be right.
Yeah, that's true. And I would agree with you. I feel like I hear that more from the grandparents than the parents. And so sometimes I have to quell the worry of the grandparent. But I think, for explaining something like tibial torsion to parents and to grandparents, we let families know that there's a certain sequence of events that happens in the tibia bone as kids grow. When they come out and when they're young, they have a little bit more inward rotation of their tibia bone. And then the tibia slowly outwardly rotates so that it gets to be about 10 to 15 degrees outward facing so that your feet point out instead of point in. And that usually stops changing by the time a child's roughly 7 or 8. So if I see a baby or an infant or toddler that has some in-toeing from their tibia bone, I usually counsel the family that time is going to correct this and no special shoe is going to correct this. And if it persists, we have ways to treat it past the age of 8.
So you can just make great fashion decisions about shoes rather than anything that's supposed to fix their feet.
Yeah, except shoes, get changed like every 5 minutes in a growing kid. So
yes, they do. It's interesting too, because every time I see a 4-month-old, as they start to want to bear weight, somebody says, they tell us that you shouldn't do this because he's going to be bow-legged. I said, oh, he's going to be bow-legged. That's just the way babies are. And that's often quite reassuring because those babies are going to want to bear weight no matter what you do.
Yes.
Let's start with feet. So why don't we just sort of run through a list of issues and explain them to us. Tell us about club feet.
So club feet, they're a really common condition that we see here, maybe more in Utah than some other places that people live. And that's just because we have a huge population of kids. But a club foot is a genetic condition. So it's not a positional issue, where metatarsus adductus is more positional from the baby. Their feet may be resting a different way inside mom. But club feet, usually there's some family link. We don't have all the genes mapped out yet for club foot, and I envision sometime before I die, maybe that will be sorted out. But we definitely have families that have a positive family history. But I can also meet kids where their first child is the only child in the family, to their knowledge, with a club foot or club feet. We see club feet now, they're a little bit more evident or diagnosed in utero at around the 20-week ultrasound. But sometimes babies come out with a club foot and the family didn't expect it. Usually we end up meeting babies with club feet within maybe the first week or two. But if they've had a family history of club feet, they usually kind of know the drill about what to do. So with respect to the club foot, I tell families that it kind of looks like a golf club. So if you look at a putter on a golf club, the foot, the club foot and the putter are kind of turned down and in. And a club foot is not passively correctable. So when you're holding a club foot, if you try to bring it to the normal weight bearing position where the foot would be on the ground, you cannot do it in a club foot. In metatarsus adductus or even a positional club foot, you can stretch the foot to the corrected position, but with a club foot, you can't. And we describe to parents that there's four deformities with a club foot. So, and we use the mnemonic CAVE for a club foot. So for the C, it's cavus, which means that you have a high arch in the foot. For the A, it's adductus, meaning the forefoot has a curvature that goes in. And that's similar to metatarsus adductus, where it looks kind of like a kidney bean. The V is for varus, which means the heel is turned in. And then E is equinus, which means the foot is pointed down and they have a really tight Achilles tendon. And you can have a unilateral club foot or you can have bilateral club feet. And they're really roughly 50-50. And we see club feet both in boys and girls. And honestly, I feel like it's seasonal. Sometimes I'll see more boys than girls, but they happen in both genders. It's a condition that requires some longer term treatment than some of the other foot things that we see in kids. Club feet, when we see and treat them, we really invest with the family that we're going to be knowing them for most of their growing life, because feet are going to continue to grow and change. And I explain to families that it's because it's congenital, it's something that the baby is born with and it likes to come back. And so we keep an eye on it as kids grow. And our treatment is directed at the fact that it can often come back. And so we want to watch it and take care of it for a long time.
The initial intervention is positioning, right?
The treatment for club feet is typically casting. And I would qualify this with not all club feet are the same. So most club feet we describe as idiopathic, meaning we don't have an exact reason. There's probably a family history, but there isn't necessarily an underlying diagnosis. If you have a baby with teratologic club feet, which means the feet are associated with a different condition, maybe arthrogryposis or spina bifida, those feet behave differently, but in general, we still treat them the same. We start off with casting, and Dr. Ignacio Ponseti, who is from Italy, he described a casting technique back in the 1950s, and he taught us that we can cast babies for club feet instead of operate on them. And the casting process is usually 5 to 7 casts done every week with plaster, which is his described technique. And then once the foot is corrected, the vast majority of babies will need to have an Achilles tendon lengthening, which sounds super scary to patients and families, but it's really just a tiny little nick of the tendon to help stretch the foot and get the foot to reach the ground. We have found that most kids who don't have an Achilles tendon lengthening, their club foot will relapse and recur pretty quickly. So in most cases, we end up doing that tendon lengthening. And then after that final cast is on, which is on for 3 weeks, we transition those children to bracing. And Dr. Ponseti and more recently a surgeon that used to be at St. Louis Shriners, Matt Dobbs, they designed some braces that we use. And effectively, it's kind of like a snowboard. There's two shoes and then there's a bar in between. And they're designed to hold either 1 foot or both feet corrected. And we use the brace. The prescribed amount of time is full time for 3 months after the first casting episode. And then the braces get subsequently weaned, so that when you're walking at roughly 12 months of age, the braces are only worn at night and they're worn until the age of 4, which sounds like a whole lot for a patient and family to deal with, but kids and families really adapt well to this, especially if they recognize that in the absence of the brace, the foot will recur. And if they put it on and make it part of their nighttime routine, their kids just do really well with it. The reason that Dr. Ponsetti picked 4 is that when patients took the brace off earlier than that, they had a lot of relapse and more casting and potentially surgeries. So 4 seems to be the right age to discontinue the braces, but we still follow kids after that.
And the amazing thing is, this is potentially a very, very disabling deformity that can be fixed. And what do we know about long-term? So somebody who has been successfully treated, do they have limitations?
No. So if you've had surgery for club feet, which really stopped happening pretty much when I was a fellow. So around 2007, at least in this state, we really stopped treating babies with surgery for club feet. So I do have patients that are older that have had surgery for club feet, and they have stiffness. They get early onset of arthritis, and they, I think, have more disability than kids treated now with the Ponsetti method. Kids treated now have really high functioning scores. We have a lot of gait analysis out there from different centers around the nation that have shown us that they might have a little bit of tightness in their Achilles tendons as they grow, but in general, they walk, run, play, they play every sport. Some of them are Olympic athletes and they're playing soccer at a high level. And so we don't expect any difference in how those kids are going to function, really, so long as the family followed the treatment plan and they haven't had relapse and it's been a straightforward case.
Amazing. Metatarsus adductus, what's the treatment for that?
For many kids, benign neglect. So it's sometimes hard talking a parent or a family into that, but metatarsus adductus is really cosmetic. It's not a functional issue the way a club foot is. And metatarsus adductus in general gets better as kids grow. So once they start walking, hopefully around 1, they usually start to improve that alignment by the time they're 5 or 7. If I have a family that really is pressuring me to try to make the foot corrected, I will consider some casting. And the only issue with casting, especially as an infant, is the foot likes to go back to being metatarsus adductus. And so then you might want to have a brace on to hold it in place, which for me, it's hard to want to put a baby in a brace that doesn't need to be in a brace. So I try to tell parents, hold tight, we're going to watch and see what this does. But by and large, it gets better on its own.
Excellent. Let's talk about some toe issues, because we get asked a lot of toe issues.
Yes.
Let's just go through a grab bag here. Curly toes.
So curly toes are super common. They're usually on both sides. It can be the second toe on both feet. It could be more than one toe on each foot. It could be 3 toes on one foot. There's no genetic link to curly toes. We really don't know why they happen, but it's associated with a tight flexor tendon on the bottom of the toe. And it makes the toe either like cock up or go under, or it can make the adjacent toe do something weird. But in general, we still recommend observing those. And often the flexor tendon stretches by the age of 5 or 6. I really don't operate on those in really young kids. If it persists and then kids start to get some curvature of the toe and some issues with shoes as they get a little bit older and maybe they get a callus, then I might recommend lengthening the curly toe. But in general, those often can get better just with time.
What about fifth toes that overlap?
It's kind of similar. So we don't see those as often as curly toes. I see an overlapping fifth toe every once in a while, maybe once a year. That might be even overstating it. But there are surgeries to correct those if they don't get better with time. And I think sometimes those can also be associated with a bunionette, which is like a little bunion on the fifth toe. So you might have to do more bony surgery for those than just soft tissue surgery. But for a lot of the toe stuff that we see, I think one of the themes that I try to reiterate to families is we usually wait till kids are a little bit bigger. Anything you do to a baby's foot or toes when they're young can recur as they grow. You can get more scar tissue, more stiffness. And so we wait to see what it does with some time. And so there's really a strong recommendation for observation at first.
Is there much functional problem with an overlapping fifth toe?
Not typically, no.
Yeah, that's been my impression too. Now, tell us about hammer toes and mallet toes.
Yes, probably more teenage population. I don't feel like I see those as often in littler kids. If you're seeing claw toes in a littler kid, you might end up having that affiliated with the condition of Charcot-Marie tooth, like a neurologic disorder. But mallet toes and hammer toes, again, are a little bit more affiliated with tight flexor tendons. And if the toe is flexible and the patient isn't having any pain or disability or shoe wear issues, then we hang tight. And if they're starting to get some rubbing on their shoes, they're getting more fixed deformity where the toe doesn't really want to stretch out, then we will sometimes recommend tendon lengthening and potentially pinning of the toe.
Okay. What about polydactyly and syndactyly? It seems to me that I see more syndactyly than polydactyly on the foot. Is that?
I think for me, and maybe that's just because of who comes in for potentially surgery, I think I see more polydactyly need surgery than syndactyly. You know, and syndactyly is kind of variable. I think syndactyly can be just the incomplete syndactyly where it's very minor and it's just maybe at the base of the junction between the two toes. It's not super common that I see more of a complete syndactyly where like the skin bridge goes all the way to the end of the toe. But polydactyly is usually familial, especially if it's on the lateral border of the foot. And we describe that as post-axial polydactyly. And that comes in various forms where you can have just a little nubbin or you can have a whole extra metatarsal and proximal, middle, and distal phalanx. There's also polydactyly that happens on the medial side of the foot at the great toe. Those, I think, are a little bit more genetic related. And just this week, I saw a baby that has something called a bracketed epiphysis, which we also describe as a delta phalanx. And that's an abnormal growth plate often around like the big toe. And that makes the big toe go into varus, like a monkey toe. Those can be often associated with polydactyly. So I definitely see polydactyly that needs surgery. And sometimes when you have polydactyly in the feet, you also have like an extra nubbin in the hand. So we usually pay attention to that as well. Polydactyly, I think we operate on at a younger age than we do syndactyly. A lot of syndactyly, we wait till kids are a bit older. And in some circumstances, we don't recommend that toes get taken apart or separated because sometimes it's just more surgical hassle than is necessary for function.
Well, I would think, especially in contrast to a partial syndactyly on the hand, a partial syndactyly on the foot would seem to me to cause no problems at all.
Yeah. So the only people I think we more often recommend a release of syndactyly in the foot might be between the great toe and the second toe.
Oh, sure.
Which again is really rare, but a lot of people want to wear flip-flops. But for the second, third, fourth, and fifth toes, if they have a little bit of a syndactyly, I try to counsel parents to just wait and see what the kid wants. And if maybe as they get older, they wish to have the toes look different or separated, then it can be addressed certainly older.
Good point. Let's talk about flat feet for a minute there, because there are different kinds of flat feet, right?
Yep. So I have this conversation a lot with people. So flat feet are kind of common until like at least the age of 5 or 7. When I see babies or toddlers with flat feet, I tell parents that this is really normal. I definitely see a lot of families who come in and ask me if their child needs orthopedic shoes when they're 3 or 4. But it's really normal not to have an arch until you're around 5 to 7. And that's just because kids walk a little bit later. You know, they walk at 1 and it takes them a while to gain the muscle and the ligamentous strength to develop the arch that they need. But then beyond the age of 5 or 7, if they don't have an arch, then I'm looking for some different things. The first thing I'm looking for is, are the feet flexible or are they stiff? You know, the child with flexible flat feet is more common than a stiff flat foot. But flat feet are common in about a quarter of our population. So, you know, 74, 75% of us have a normal arch, about a quarter of us have a flatter arch. And then there's a rare breed of kid who gets a cavus foot or a high arch foot. But flat feet are kind of typical for the population. If you have a flexible flat foot without a tight Achilles tendon, I typically recommend observation. If you have a tight Achilles tendon with flat feet, sometimes those kids have pain. And they might do better with some physical therapy for some stretching exercises. Maybe they do better with a foot orthotic. And then if you have stiff flat feet, then we start looking for other things like tarsal coalitions where bones are fused and they're not supposed to be. Flexible flat feet, I think by and large, do really well. I know people well into adulthood that have no interventions for their flexible flat feet. But the kids with tarsal coalitions, they may have stiffness and pain that leads them more to the surgery realm, where we might have to remove the coalition or do some secondary surgeries because of the flat foot alignment.
It seems to me that if you go to a running store, that there's going to be a lot of analysis of your gait. Some of that at least seems to be related to the flexibility of your foot. Am I mistaken there?
No, it's all about the flexibility. So, you know, when I see a kid in my office with flat feet, I have them walk up and down the hall. I have them walk on their heels and on their tiptoes, and you can get a really good sense of somebody's flexibility with just those really simple maneuvers. Mm-hmm. I ask them if they can stand on one foot or both feet up on their tiptoes. That's called a single or a double heel rise. And that really tells us flexibility. And if kids are flexible, they often usually don't have pain and they don't have a lot of dysfunction. And we observe those kids. Every once in a while in the 9 to 11 year old kid where they're starting to grow a little bit and they get some Sievers disease or some like apophysitis, maybe those kids do better with like a heel cup or a foot orthotic. But a lot of kids with really flexible feet, we just counsel them that they're really okay and they're a normal part of us.
Clearly see kids in clinic who there does seem to be a relationship between their flexible feet and foot pain. But if a quarter of all of us have flexible feet, clearly it's a smaller group of them who have pain associated with it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think pain is rare. A lot of times parents just want their kids' feet to have a bigger arch, but we just try to remind them that really it's not going to cause a functional issue. I have a really good friend who's probably almost in his 40s. He's got pancake looking feet and he runs marathons and he's just got really flexible but super flat feet and they're okay.
You touched on Tarsal Coalition. Can you tell us a little bit more about Tarsal Coalition?
Yeah. So tarsal coalitions are associated with more stiff or rigid flat feet. And the two most common coalitions we see are calcaneo-navicular coalitions and then subtalar or talocalcaneal coalitions. I feel like calcaneo-navicular coalitions don't have as much stiffness as the subtalar coalitions do. And the calcaneo-navicular coalitions also often don't have as much deformity as the subtalar coalitions do. Some kids will have a little bit of an arch with a calcaneo-navicular coalition, but the subtalar coalition kids, they're really pretty flat, and they really lack a lot of mobility, especially in the subtalar joint and in the hind foot. You can't really invert and evert the foot very well in those kids, and that's really an obvious sign, I think, when we see those patients in our office that there might be something else here. And there's some x-rays that we can get for kids in the office that can help us with that diagnosis, but in many patients, we'll still advance to a CT scan or potentially an MRI scan to look for a fibrous coalition. In some kids, you don't just have one coalition, so you want to be checking for others and make sure that you're treating anything that's going on in the foot when you have somebody with a stiff, flat foot. I do think those are the subset of patients that end up with more surgery, and they might need to have their Achilles tendon lengthened. They may need to have flat foot reconstruction where they get their heel corrected and then their arch corrected. But those are definitely patients we see, you know, maybe 9, 10, but more teenager age kids.
And how's that kid going to present to me in the office?
So I think they're going to present with foot pain. I would say for the most part, you're going to see somebody with a pretty flat arch. If you ask them to walk up and down the hall, they're probably going to walk okay. But if you ask them to get up on their tiptoes, they are not going to be able to get up on their tiptoes. They will not have an arch when they try to get up on their tiptoe. And if you're trying to test like their Achilles tendon flexibility, I bet it's pretty tight. So in the office for us, we'll have somebody lay down with their knee extended and then their knee flexed, and they're not going to have a lot of flexibility in their Achilles. They just won't dorsiflex their foot very much. And then sometimes for the calcaneo-navicular coalition kids, they might report that they have pain on the top of their foot where the calcaneo-navicular coalition is. And that's kind of on the top of the midfoot, but they don't always present with that necessarily. It's more of like a vague activity-related complaint of pain.
Perfect. You know, part of the reason I asked about the tarsal coalition thing is that most of the things we're talking about today are things that we look at and say, so what should I do about this? Coming back to another one of those, you touched briefly on hallux valgus, but tell me about what I should do about hallux valgus.
So bunions or hallux valgus are seen a little bit more, I think, in girls than boys. So I'm thinking in your office, you're going to see a female patient. They do also often have a positive family history where maybe mom or grandma or somebody had a bunion. It's not really common that we see kids with bunions that present young, but you know, every couple of months I'll have somebody who presents with a bunion and it can be one side or both. With respect to bunions, how we treat them, I think, is somewhat based on the age of presentation. There is a procedure that we can now do when kids have a fair amount of growth remaining, where we can do guided growth at the base of the first metatarsal, which is similar to how we treat like knock knees and bow legs for kids who are still growing. But that can help decrease the degree of deformity that the big toe has. doesn't necessarily correct it completely, but it can help prevent it from maybe getting a little bit worse. But beyond that very minor procedure, for a lot of bunions, we try to tell families to hold tight with the toe and the foot for correction until you're a little bit older. Similar to the other things we talked about today, when you do a bunion surgery and a young kid, let's say 8, 10, 12 years of age, the relapse and recurrence rate is really high. So we counsel families, we really want to wait until kids are a little bit closer to skeletal maturity so that hopefully we avoid secondary procedures. But we can consider doing guided growth to kids with a bunion. So in a pediatrician office, if you have a pretty young kid with a bunion, I'd say refer him to one of us and we can see how much growth the patient has remaining and if that's an option. And then otherwise, we might ask them to hold tight and kind of keep watching them as they get a little bit older.
Is any of this related to footwear choice?
No.
Okay. So it's not from wearing their own shoes.
No. I think in adults, we see that much more than in kids. In kids, the bunion, I think by and large, is probably family history related more than anything.
Very interesting. I want to talk about one more thing about feet. It's something that we get asked about all the time, and that's toe walking. Yeah. Kids run around a lot and are on their toes a lot. What should we be watching for?
So the things that I do when I see somebody with toe walking is, first and foremost, is I get a birth history and a milestone history. So, you know, I want to know if the child was born on time. Did they have any issues at the time of birth or perinatally? Did they require oxygen? Did they need mechanical ventilation? Did they end up in the NICU? And then once they get out of the hospital, you know, what did their development look like? Did they sit on time? Did they start walking on time? And then I also ask at the time at which the toe walking started. A lot of infants just start toe walking as they start walking, like they'll intermittently be up on their tiptoes. And I think we consider that a little bit more like habitual or idiopathic toe walking. If I have a family that starts toe walking and the child is like 3 or 5, then that makes me think about a whole host of other things. So I think, you know, if the birth history is suggestive of maybe this child could have cerebral palsy or some other underlying neuromuscular disorder, that points me in a different direction. If they have a completely normal birth history and they just started toe walking when they started walking and they do it every once in a while, but if you tell the child to stand flat with their feet and they can walk flat-footed, then I'm probably a little bit less worried about those kids. And like this week, I saw a 2-year-old who's been toe walking for about a year, and she's born on time, super normal child, normal exam, no spasticity, gait is normal. And I counsel the family that this is really probably just going to go away on its own, usually by school age. But if I have a concern about their birth history, about when they reached milestones, about when they started toe walking, then I'm definitely getting a neurologist involved with the patient in addition to me. And I feel like toe walking is one of those conversations that's kind of a long conversation with the family. I try to explain to parents that there's like two types of toe walking. There's idiopathic toe walking, and then there's other reasons for toe walking. And I usually have a sense, I think, of which is which, but, you know, I would not hesitate to get advanced imaging for a child that has any concerning birth or developmental history, where I need to look at their brain or their spine to see if there's any additional diagnoses we need to be assessing and addressing.
Is there anything from a prevention point of view that we should be thinking about there for an idiopathic toe walker?
No, you know, I see a lot of kids that toe walk that are idiopathic and they're really functional. It doesn't seem to me until they're like 9, 10 and up that maybe it gets in the way with who they are and what they're doing. I also know that like some of our fastest sprinters in the world, like our Olympic athletes, are kind of toe walkers. Mm-hmm. And so for many kids, I don't mind it that much. And I have to convince a parent every once in a while that it's really okay to watch it. When somebody is getting stiffer and they're stuck up on their tiptoes and they can't get flat on their feet and stand correctly, then those are the kids that we start to think about surgery. And short of surgery, we can think about bracing, we can think about Botox and casting, we can think about physical therapy, and then surgery is an endpoint. But usually I get to know those families and have a relationship with them before I'm starting to recommend some of those things. But preventative measures, no.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much. This has been very, very enlightening. I'm going to take a lot of this back to what I do on a day-to-day basis. Next week, we'll talk about more stuff. Marcelo, thanks so much for your time today. For those of you who have questions, please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com, and we'll deal with those in a couple of weeks. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again next week.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.